Welcome to episode 63 of the Hunt Backcountry podcast, presented to you by XO Mountain Gear. In this week's episode, we are answering your questions. We are firm believers in the fact that there are no stupid questions, and sometimes I know guys might feel like it, like, hey, I want to know about this or that, but I feel like it's a dumb question to ask. Well, no fear. Beginners, experienced, it doesn't matter. We're here to help all of you. And so we take some listener questions in this episode more on the basic end of things and help you guys get the information that you need. As always, if you have questions to add, please email us at podcast@exomountaingear.com, as I'm sure we will do more of these episodes in the future. All right, so on tonight's show, we answer a wide range of questions. What state you should head to, how to find certain areas, public land ethics, etiquette, running into other hunters, what do you do, picking a spot for your camp when you're in the backcountry, essential pieces of gear, simple things like how to set up a quick disconnect with the Sawyer water filter that you might have heard us discuss in the past, advice for sleeping in the backcountry, rifle calibers, so much more. So, hope you guys enjoy this episode. We are going to come out with part two next week. But again, if you have any other questions to add, anything we don't cover in this episode or the next one, go ahead and email us to podcast@exomountaingear.com, and we will make that part of a future episode as well. Enjoy the show. Well, Steve, Lenny, how are you guys doing tonight?
Fantastic, man. It's a snowy day in Boise. We're not used to getting this much snow, but
is it really?
There's over a foot in my front yard, which
I
think my wife said she saw somewhere that it was like a record for the last 30 years or something like that.
Time to get the machines out, man.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, it is, like, literally it is crazy. I mean, people with just like a regular car really can almost get around. It's insane.
Yeah. Wow. On my way home, there was like six cars just on the like 4 feet off the road, you know, just like,
wow,
not going anywhere.
So bad for them.
Yeah, they're calling it like 1 to 3 inches here tonight, which means people will act like it's the apocalypse, and I'm sure there's no bread at the grocery store, and there's like, you know, no milk, and that's pretty much how people roll around here. It's like the end of the world.
Yeah,
so
that's funny.
Cool. So the agenda tonight is just to answer a bunch of questions. I mean, we know, you know, just from hearing from you guys, the listeners, that, you know, there's questions out there that, you know, we have covered or we need to cover in more detail. There's questions that we haven't covered, and that's probably our own fault because we've kind of looked over some things. And so we just want to throw this episode out there, which might, you know, turn into a series of episodes, and basically say, hey, there are no stupid questions. Let's tackle some of like the beginner stuff, the basic stuff. Because, you know, not that we're experts by any means, but we have some years of experience under our belts. And so there's things that we take for granted in terms of knowledge. And, you know, like we were just talking before the show, Lenny, you looking back at like previous years when you got first started and think about, man, the position you were in at that point and the information that you wish you would have known, right?
Yeah, it's crazy. I pulled up some old pictures when I first started backpacking. For one, I don't know how I carried that pack. If I carried that pack today, I'd just be complaining all the way.
Well, you're old now, though, you know, so.
true. yeah, but it's just amazing, you know, when you start and you just don't know what you don't know until you do it.
Yeah, and that's a great point, because no matter what we cover in terms of knowledge, like, I mean, that's just one thing I always recommend to guys, is just get started, just get out there and do it, because the best way to learn is to learn in the field. As good as the podcast is, as good as reading articles are, things like that, like, just get out there and make mistakes and you'll learn for sure.
Yeah, so that's definitely my number one advice is at the end of the day. Yeah, reiterate exactly what you just said. You just got to go. And you're not going to learn until you do, because everyone's going to have different ways to tackle different problems, and you're going to figure out what works best for you.
Yeah,
and it's going to evolve. You know, every year, Lenny and I, our hunting evolves, and our backpacking along with that changes every single year, and, you know, major ways and slight ways.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, and speaking of getting started and just doing it, I mean, for sure, if, you know, you guys as beginners can find somebody with some experience, and maybe they don't hunt the same way you do or the way you want to or anything like that, but like, just, I would, you know, encourage everybody to soak up information from anybody they can, and ideally firsthand. I mean, I did much of my learning on my own, and so I know how difficult that is, but man, it's so helpful whether you hunt with somebody or whether you can just sit down and, you know, have coffee or a beer and, you know, learn from somebody, just talk to somebody. I mean, if you can find somebody to learn from, then that's definitely the way to do it. Do you have any advice, Steve, on like somebody who's out there, they want to learn to hunt or they want to venture into the backcountry and, you know, not just hunt from the road or what have you, on finding somebody that they can learn from?
That's a great, man. I mean, if you immediately don't have somebody that comes to mind, I would just reach out and talk to people, you know, get on social media, is as much as I dislike social media in a lot of ways, it can be great in that aspect for, you know, just getting to know people, and you might find somebody who maybe they're your age, but they've been backpacking for a long time. So, and then, you know, maybe go down to archery shop or something like that and just try to get out there and meet people. I don't know how else you would do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Archery shop, or, you know, if there's an archery club that does shoots, 3D shoots, something like that. I mean,
yeah,
you know, there's more and more events these days. You think of things like the Full Draw Film Tour or Train to Hunt, like all these different like hunting centric events that gather, you know, backcountry hunters into a spot. Like, start going to those things and just try and meet people, you know, make connections. Yeah. So I think that'd be a good way to do it.
I agree.
So cool. So one question we got, and we got this a few months ago, we just recently reached out on social media and said, you know, hey, there's no stupid questions. So what are some questions that you guys want answered? And so we'll get to some of those, but this is a funny, fun email, that we got a couple months ago, and it was back from an episode where we had Wes Seiler on, and he kind of has a wide audience. And so I think having him on and interviewing him brought in some folks to the podcast that weren't already fans of the podcast and probably weren't hunters. But I had to crack up this guy's email and just to read his quote. It says, okay, so my noob question is, what's up with public land hunting? How do I not get shot by some random drunk ass stranger? How do I know where to go? How do I get tags? How do I get a carcass out of the woods? And so I guess we could probably devote a whole episode to these questions, but what's up with public land hunting? And then he talks about how not to get shot by somebody. And there, not to answer that question specifically, I guess wear blaze orange if it's rifle season would be some advice. But we did have quite a few questions about hunting public land and then specifically interacting with other hunters and some sort of like etiquette and, you know, ethics, kind of like right away type questions. And so, you know, some guys mentioned scenarios where it's, you know, you bump a group of elk and then you realize that there was another hunter also pursuing that group, or you're putting the stalk on something and then you see another hunter, or, you know, you get up to a glassing spot and there's somebody else there. So kind of talk through, Lenny, maybe some encounters that you've had, in the backcountry with other hunters, or just some general advice for like, what do you do when you encounter other hunters on public land? Is there any sort of right away or etiquette, any sort of knowledge there?
Yeah, this Lenny when he's young and dumb, or Lenny when he's a little bit older and smarter.
tell us what not to do, and then tell us what to do.
You know, unfortunately, you know, when I was younger and probably a little more hot-headed, you know, I definitely got some situations. I mean, I know where some of these guys are coming from. I mean, I've had a situation where two people are shooting the same elk. We get there, we don't know who did it. You know, guys are standing there with guns, and you're saying, well, who shot it? And people are getting mad, and tempers are flaring. You know, so I'd say my biggest advice is don't avoid people and pretend. You know, I mean, I think what I normally do is I just walk up and talk to them and say, hey, which way are you going? Where are you hunting? Or if you already have an idea, you know, you might just try to come out and say, hey, I'm planning on hunting over here. Where are you hunting? You know, it kind of at least kind of lay the groundwork of that you want to work with them. But, you know, the truth is it's public land and everyone's got to hunt there. So, you know, I guess I'd say my advice is I see a lot of people try to, you know, hurry and get in front of you or do this or that. I think the best thing to do is literally talk to people, ask them what they're doing, where they're going, and then try to create a plan of where you can both hunt an area and, you know, not bump into each other.
Yeah. So it's almost like instead of like being passive aggressive, meaning pretend they're not there, but be really aggressive to make a move around them. Just be more direct and confront it.
Yep, exactly. To me, I think that's the best strategy.
Yeah.
I mean, it you know, and the truth of the matter is, man, you get to talking to people, especially for someone who's fairly new, you wouldn't believe how many people open up and start telling you, like, oh, yeah, I've hunted here 10 years, and, you know, I've seen elk here, seen elk there. I mean, you don't know what they're going to tell you and, you know, what you can glean from them. So I think it's way better.
Yeah. Any encounters or lessons learned there, Steve, for you?
Reiterate exactly what you said. I mean, I think in a scenario where, you know, you see a group of hunters or something like that, yeah, we'll go. And if it's within a reasonable, you know, if they're on the same ridge or, you know, you're going to naturally cross paths, just go talk to them and don't avoid the situation. This is kind of a bow hunting scenario, too. I think during rifle season, I don't get out much, but it's just kind of all out chaos. I think in sometimes, and if I see another hunter, I'll just start walking the other direction. You know, maybe if I see them going to where I wanted to go, I'll just turn 90 degrees or 180 degrees and just go find another place to hunt. And if you're in an area where there's like people all around you, I guess I don't know what you do there. Hike out and go find somewhere else, you know? Cause it just, if you get that many people, especially maybe during a rifle season, you could, you know, it's just crowded. But it is public land and people can frankly do whatever they want as far as, you know, there's no set in stone rules. It's just ethics and everyone has their different interpretation of that. So, talk to them. If that's not a feasible option, just go hike the other direction and find place to yourself. I mean, I think that's all the reason why most of us love to backpack is that's an issue that isn't going to pop up, frankly, that often.
So another kind of public land question that came up while we're on the topic was just kind of wondering about public land ethics in regards to off-road vehicles, you know, quads, motorbikes, etc. This guy was saying, you know, he sees a lot of scrutiny about that form of travel, but clearly there's places where it's allowed. And it seems like, you know, there's hunters and other outdoors folks fighting over the issue. So he was kind of wondering what is, our stance on the issue in terms of, vehicle travel in the backcountry, for hunting. I mean, I think from my perspective, the answer is pretty dang simple is, you know, there's certain places where it's allowed and there's certain places where it's not. When it's not allowed, don't use them. When it is allowed, use them and use them, you know, smart and responsible and, you know, not in a non-destructive way. I mean, I know that you guys have used, you know, motorbikes to get in so far and then hike in from there. But is there, you know, much more to be said on that topic?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I don't have any issues with certain aspects of it. Personally, I would love if every trail and road was closed. You know, just that means there's that much more remote backcountry that I can hike into. But I also got to understand the viewpoint of, you know, maybe some guys are up there in age and still want to kind of get away from crowds, but can't really go hike 6 miles. So the ability to jump on a quad or motorcycle and cover some distance and then hunt from there is, you know, something that's appealing. So I think, you know, in Idaho, they do a good job of, there's a lot of areas that are, you know, foot traffic only and trails. And if that's what you're after, you know, pick out those areas and don't go to a place where there's, you know, motorcycles are allowed on the trail. Don't go hike it and then, you know, bitch and complain that somebody came up on a motorcycle because that's, you know, that's just your own fault. They were doing everything legal. It is frustrating when people abuse that. No matter, you know, what walk of life you come from or where you're, what you're doing, people are always going to abuse the laws and regulations. So that's just a part of it, unfortunately. And I mean, if you catch somebody doing it, I just talked to a guy a couple months ago that had people that came in on bicycles on a trail and, you know, and reported them once he got back and hopefully they got a ticket and they won't do it again. you know, so just follow the rules and be responsible about it.
All right. So jumping back to that guy's original email after he talked about, public land hunting and not getting shot by somebody and, you know, encounters with others, which we addressed. He asked, how do I know where to go? And that's clearly a question that, you know, we received from other folks as well. Just a few to read them off, from one guy who's saying, you know, where does a person from the Midwest start? He wants to get into the West and start doing some DIY hunting, but has no idea where to begin. Another guy's saying, you know, so many states out West are known for backcountry hunting. What is the best state to start for a non-resident hunter looking to get into the backcountry? You guys are from Idaho, have always hunted Idaho and have the luxury of hunting there. I'm the Midwest guy, so I guess this question is more to me, but I mean, certainly it is, or can be overwhelming for sure, to come from the East or the Midwest and just to figure out the whole system. Every state has different rules. Every state has different opportunities in terms of, you know, obtaining tags and then how they separate units and zones. And, you know, so it's for sure it's overwhelming. Again, kind of like hunting itself, I think you just have to dig in, just start to do some research, start to ask questions, start to, you know, do some searches online and things like that. But in terms of where to start, if you're from the Midwest or from out East, I mean, you kind of have to, I think, start with what species do you want to hunt? Because, you know, what might be a great non-resident opportunity for elk in one state is completely different as a non-resident opportunity for mule deer or for antelope or for black bear or for what have you. And so I think narrowing down what species you want to go after is a great place to start. I started hunting out West with elk, so that's where a lot of my context is. Everybody gets pissed off when I say that Idaho is a great state. You guys probably will too, but for non-residents, it's a super friendly state in terms of obtaining tags and the cost of doing that. Colorado is a great state. Those two are probably the top two in terms of ease of obtaining a tag and the cost of it. But keep in mind, especially with states like Colorado, where, you know, I go and millions of other people seem to go. I mean, Colorado's the furthest east, essentially, with good elk hunting opportunity. It's the easiest tags to obtain, and so it gets hammered by non-residents. That isn't to say that you shouldn't go there. I was there last year, killed a bull, and I'll be there again this year. But I would look at other states that most guys are avoiding. Montana has some opportunities. It's going to cost you a bit more. So really, I would do the research. I would say that it pays off to think outside the box, to flank what everybody else might be doing. Most guys are going to be doing Colorado. A lot of guys are going to be doing Idaho, but there's other opportunities out there. So I would say, you know, start with a species and then start looking at, okay, where can I hunt that species? When can I get a tag? How can I get a tag? How much is that going to be? Obviously can't answer all those questions in this podcast, but, you know, you just pretty much have to hit the state game sites and start doing research. Any other context? I mean, you guys have clearly hunted other states beyond Idaho, so just any other context in terms of non-resident hunting that you think would be helpful for beginners, Steve?
Yeah. I mean, you just got to jump in. Like you said, there's so much information out there, whether it's the fish and game agencies, which are usually a great place to start. You know, some of the different magazines out there that publish a lot of articles. And I think alone on the fish and game website, you could probably like jump into, say, Wyoming, start searching for, you know, over the counter tags or tags you could get with 1 point. And then that's going to narrow you down to like 10 units. And then from there, you could kind of figure out, you know, start doing some research, you know, jump around online. There's a lot of information you could dig out on forums that would kind of help steer you and try to, you know, narrow that down to 1 or 2 units. And then from there, I would probably get on Google Earth and, you know, overlay that unit and start picking apart and see which one has the type of country that I'm looking for. You know, if it was a mule deer hunt, open high country. And then apply for it and then start doing your, you know, research from there. As far as once you pick that unit out, then you just kind of get more and more in detail until, frankly, I mean, I can't imagine Mark, for you, like coming out without scouting, you know, that would be that's a foreign concept for me to at least not go poke my head somewhere, and at least scout it out or have an idea of the type of country I'm going to. But, yeah, you just gotta start, you know, and it's not going to be perfect and you're going to make mistakes and you may go into an area and it stinks. And so you should probably have plans B and C and, but you're definitely not going to kill something sitting on the couch. So just get out there and get started.
Yeah. Yeah, I think just to hammer on what you said, I mean, expectations are huge. And if you were a guy in the Midwest or, you know, out east, I mean, here's the blunt way to put it, and you have to, like, accept this fact. Be prepared to spend $1,500 to come home with nothing. Because it's going to yeah. cost you at least $1,500 to, like, get your tag, to get out there, to get back home, you know, gas money or what, you know, gear, all that stuff. It's going to be at least $1,500. And the fact is, like, most guys, whether you're non-resident or resident, go home empty-handed. And so that's just like something, I'm not saying like pessimistic. I'm just saying, be prepared for that and go into it trying to get something else out of it besides just killing something. I mean, the experience is amazing. Learning the lessons is helpful. But don't, you know, don't expect that it's just going to be swimming all the time and just be perfect. I mean, you know, I think, you know, the guy I help hunt elk with, you know, we're both non-residents and have gone to Colorado, and two out of the last 3 years we've come home with bulls. That's really good. But, you know, there's guys who, you know, hunt for years and years and years and don't. And I think that's okay. But that's part of the process of learning. It's an expensive way to learn, but again, it's about more than just killing something. And, you know, I value that time in the backcountry so much that, you know, to me, it's worth it regardless of what happens in the end. Clearly, you know, it's nice to come home with a couple hundred pounds of meat for sure.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Steve and I, we've been planning a caribou hunt in Alaska. So we're kind of in that same, you know, with people coming out west. And, you know, it's literally just like you guys said. I mean, I'm jumping on forums. I'm looking on the fishing game websites. I'm looking on guide websites. You know, just kind of see what they're saying and pictures. And, you know, it's just really, you've got to just dive all the way in and almost just like immerse yourself in it to you know, get comfortable where you're going to go. But at the same time, you know, I told Steve today, I said, you know what, if we don't see a caribou in 6 days, you know, that expectation, you know, it's not the end of the world.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the experience.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, you know, a guy later down asked about resources, you know, and how to learn. And I mean, resources, as you mentioned, Steve, the fish and game websites are, you know, incredibly valuable. Forums are incredibly helpful. Obviously there's podcasts like this one and others. And there's so much out there. You know, not to plug my own stuff, cause I'm not really keeping it active anymore and kind of don't care, but you know, I had a site, Soul Adventure, SOLE adventure.com. And I, you know, wrote, God, I don't know, 50 probably plus articles as I was like a Midwesterner who knows nothing and learned to hunt elk. And that was kind of A to Z on everything I learned and everything that I found helpful. So that might be helpful to guys, but yeah, I mean, there's just so much out there. Just dive into it. You know, I would say it all starts with committing to do it. You know, there's never enough time, there's never enough money, but just make a plan and make it happen. And I guarantee you that you won't regret it. So,
yeah. And you're going to learn from it. I mean, like Lenny and I, well, it'll be our second trip to Alaska. And the first one was, you know, we've recorded a podcast about it. It was fairly a disaster in some senses. And we learned a lot. And this next trip up there is going to be a lot smoother and better because, you know, we just got the process started and learned from it.
Yeah.
Yep. There's no other way to figure that out.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't matter how much research you do and this and that, there's always going to be something. So just get started.
Yeah. Well, that covers, you know, some of the big topics in terms of like, you know, where to go. And I know we covered that from a high level and there's a lot more detail that could be covered. And then public land encounters, which are, you know, kind of the two things I think guys have a ton of questions about. But, you know, from here, we're going to shotgun and jump around on a few different topics that we've gotten questions about. One, you know, interesting question that it for sure would be interesting to hear from, you know, you, Steve and Lenny, because I know your style of hunting and how this plays out. But, You know, something that I thought about a lot too in the past was, how do you pick a spot for backcountry camp while hunting archery elk? This guy says, I'm always worried about setting up in a spot where my scent will be blown over the mountain at night and make the elk quiet, or in a place where the elk will pass by and then spook them away. Any input would be great. So you guys, I know, have camped quite close to some elk, let's say. What are your thoughts on where to sleep, or, you know, are you going to spook elk out of the area if you're kind of sleeping in the wrong spot?
We've slept a lot out there, I'll tell you that. And we had that same fear for years, wouldn't you say, Steve? You know, we tried to get on the backside of a ridge or this or that. And yeah. Then inevitably, over the years, there's some places where, you know, honestly, it's just too steep, and there's only one or two places that literally you could pitch a tent. And so we ended up pitching a tent there just because there's no other choice, and the elk were right there and all not bugling. And, you know, to be honest with you, I think as soon as it gets dark, those elk instincts change, where even if they get wind of you, they're not going to blow out of there. They may move away a little bit, you know, a couple hundred yards there. But in my mind, I think as soon as it gets dark, they don't care.
Yeah. Lenny hit it. We used to, one of our favorite spots we backpacked into was kind of the base of all these canyons. And we'd camp down there in the very, very bottom, just always afraid of, you know, the wind. So that down there in the bottom, the wind would be blowing down canyon and out of there. And we weren't, you know, we were felt good about that. And then when we switched to packing up camp every day and hunting on our back, you know, and just sleeping where, you know, wherever we were when it got dark, that's exactly what happened. Is that I remember we were on the side of this mountain and just like right into elk all the way up until pitch black. And then we're just like, dude, we're on the side of this 3,500 foot mountain. There's not a flat spot anywhere. We just started climbing until we found like basically this elk bed to kind of pitch the tent in. And then we woke up or in the middle of the night, there's elk walking through camp and elk bugling all around us. And we woke up in the morning and they were 400 yards away, and we're like, man, we can't believe they didn't blow out of the country. And ever since then, we really don't pay that much attention to it. We just camp and wake up and the elk are there. I mean, it might be different in areas that are highly pressured, but at least where we're at, it just seems to be a non-issue.
Yeah.
Yep, I agree. I mean, this year, you know, I backpacked in solo, and I mean, I had an elk that night just screaming his head off 70 yards from camp. There's elk, you know, 50 yards away from where I slept all night. They didn't care.
Yeah, I mean, that's been my experience as well. Something I also worried a lot about. But I mean, the last, you know, couple of years, we've camped quite high in Colorado for the relative area, have had elk all around us all night, have woken up to elk within 200 yards of camp. The very first year I hunted elk, I hunted in Colorado, but then I also drew a cow tag in Kentucky. And my very first morning there in Kentucky, I woke up to about 60 or 70 head, like scattered in every direction around the tent within a couple hundred yards. It's just pretty crazy. So yeah, I would say, you know, just what you started with, Lenny, it's almost like their guard in a way goes down, you know, when the sun goes down. It's pretty wild, but yeah, for sure. Don't make it a huge consideration. I don't think you should, you know, throw all caution to the wind and try and be stinky or anything, but, you know, keep a decent camp and, you know, use common sense, but don't be too cautious, would be the way I would put it.
Yeah. As you're saying that, I mean, we're definitely like pitching the tent and cooking our, you know, meals and stuff at night. We're whispering and we're quiet. We're not like making a bunch of noise or anything like that. So it's definitely, you know, we're keeping a low profile as we can.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That could obviously matter.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And obviously I think that's completely different from mule deer. So just,
yeah.
Yeah. That's
true. We won't talk about that, but I think it's completely different from mule deer. You don't want to be close to them anytime.
Yeah. So yep. I guess, you know, as you say that, Lenny, I completely agree. Guys are going to be wondering, well, what the heck do you do for mule deer then? So what's, you know, for guys who are out there wondering, what is your strategy then for high country mule deer hunting, and how are you setting camp? Because I know that you guys run into the same situation in terms of being in vertical country, have limited options to pitch a tent. So, I mean, what decisions are you making there for mule deer?
I think that we're just a little, well, you know, with mule deer, we move a lot more, I would say. You know, with elk, we don't have to move quite as much. So with mule deer, you know, you're never glassing, you know, with elk, you're 200, 300 yards in front of you all the time. And mule deer, you know, you're half a mile out in front of you. So I think it just gives you more time to plan. And usually you're kind of up high on ridges anyways. You're not like halfway between the top and the bottom. There's nowhere to camp. So it makes it a little bit easier.
Yeah. To elaborate on that. Yeah. We're really basing a mule deer hunt around glassing points. Cause that's everything. So, like trying to think of, opening day, not this year, but last year, Lenny and I were camped up on very top of this knife ridge. And, you know, we were all the way across the basin where we were expecting to see deer. We definitely pitched camp. It was fairly exposed, actually, the tent, just because it was the only flat spot up there. But it was far enough away. We weren't too worried about that. And yeah, the deer, you know, half a mile away, and we're not so worried about scent at that point. And then we're just running ridges, basically, until we find something to stalk. So it's kind of a completely different scenario.
Yeah. Well, actually, one more question, kind of while we're on the topic of pitching a tent and nighttime and all that. Guys were asking about advice for sleeping in the backcountry. This guy was saying that his biggest obstacle to enjoying backpack hunting is sleeping at night. So what advice do you guys have there, Steve? I know you've had some issues, I guess you could say.
I would just say lots of Advil PM. One of our early Pure Elevation videos, I remember shooting Lenny and he was like dropping, you know, his two or three Advil PM, and he's like, I'm going to take so many of these, a bear could chew my leg off and I'm not going to know.
Yeah.
And that's basically, you know, that's the only way I sleep. I get any decent sleep anyways. And there's lots of, you know, there's so many different pads on the market, and for a long time I've used a Therm-a-Rest NeoAir, and then this year we recorded a few episodes back, we talked about that a little bit, and I was bouncing around trying some different ones because I kind of slept pretty crappy this year, for whatever reason, just getting old, I guess. So yeah, and I think as far as, you know, one thing to be said is just the comfort inside your tent, maybe, you know, like, you, if you tried sleeping in a bivy sack and slept like crap, there's a sense of security inside of a tent. So maybe that person's coming from that perspective of, you know, I definitely seem to sleep better in a nice fully enclosed shelter. Right? I don't know. Lenny, your thoughts?
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I definitely prefer a tent, and part of it is that, you know, a little feeling of security in there. And again, I think it just comes with experience, man. I mean, trust me, man, the first time I went out in the wilderness and slept in a tent by myself, I mean, I'll just admit, I was scared to death, man. Okay. And you know, and honestly, the Tylenol PM, that does help. Cause once you do doze off, you kind of stay out for a while versus before, man, you're just like in and out, in and out, in and out. And there's just really no replacement for that than spending time out there. You know, now, you know, obviously I'm older, I've spent a lot of nights out there, and it kind of doesn't bother me anymore. Just cause I've done it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. For me,
that's one of my, go ahead, Mark.
No, I was going to say, for me, a huge, you know, help, and something that I held out on from doing for a long time, just in the interest of, it seems so, you know, like such a Madonna to have it, but I got one of those backpacking pillows, the inflatable backpacking pillows, and my life has never been the same. You know, for the few ounces that like a Sea to Summit inflatable pillow, I mean, it's made so much difference in how comfortable I sleep. I tend to be, you know, more of a side sleeper and a bit of a toss and turner, and God, the freaking few ounces and the ridiculous amount of money that they charge for them has been worth every penny. And I've slept so much better, with that, for sure. It's just, you know, falling asleep usually isn't a problem for me because I'm so freaking dang tired from going all day and going hard. But staying asleep is another issue. So, like you guys, I'll take some Advil PM or something. But man, with the pillow, I sleep so much better.
Yeah, I would definitely second that. I got one of those Sea to Summit little inflatable ones, and it's money.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, again, nothing will replace experience. I guess you could probably go to REI or something and buy a pad and sleep on it in your house one night just to kind of test it out. But if you're somebody who's, uncomfortable, you know, there's some really comfy pads out there. It's just how much weight do you want to pack? You know,
yeah.
There's 4-inch thick pads that are just super lush and probably like sleeping on your bed at home, but they're going to weigh, you know, 3 pounds. versus a Therm-a-Rest Neoware that weighs, you know, 12 ounces and is, you know, it's only two inches thick or 2.5 inches thick, whatever it is. So that's something to weigh for sure. If you are struggling with sleeping, you know, try a different pad that's heavier. That's what I tried this year for myself.
I would say that weight, like, is worth it if you're going to be out, especially if you're going to be out there more than like a weekend. You know, if you're going to be out for a 6 to 7 day hunt, if you're not sleeping, that's going to start catching up with you for sure.
Right. Yes. I was laughing earlier at my first backpacking trip. You know, it's probably 2006 maybe. I couldn't find anybody to go with me. I wanted to go hunt elk. I wanted to backpack, and I hiked in there and glassed up some elk at dark, pitched my, you know, I had this freaking big old marmot two-man tent and pitched it, and I don't think I packed a pistol in there, and that sucker was in my hand the entire freaking night, and I remember just like every freaking twig that broke. I mean, every single thing. Like, I mean, the middle of the night, I was literally like, I'm just going to hike out of here. This is freaking miserable. This sucks. I'm never going to do it again. And I woke up and hunted, and the hunting sucked, and I hiked out of there. I literally wasn't even back to the truck, and I was already planning my next backpacking trip. So,
yeah,
it's just a funny, great memory I have of just, I mean, I was scared to death. You know, I was like something stupid, like 7 miles in there, way further than I should have been on a solo elk hunt. And, you know, but that's, again, part of the process. You're just going to learn from it and just start doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, and that process and learning, and I mean, it's kind of how we started the show, was saying there's nothing like learning in the field. Just to reiterate, especially for you guys, you know, well, really no matter where you're at, I was going to say, especially for the Midwest or Eastern guys, but really anybody who's new to backcountry or backpack style hunting, don't try stuff for the first time on your hunt. Like, be making trips out there at any time of the year, whether you can sneak one night away, whether you can sleep in your yard just to test a sleeping pad or a tent or anything. I mean, just before you go on a hunt, like, you shouldn't be worrying about these gear items. You shouldn't be worrying about sleep. You shouldn't be worrying about anything but hunting. And so to do that and then have your system dialed, you need to be doing things outside of the hunting season, testing gear, you know, sleeping outside, figuring out what works for you and what doesn't and all that. So, I mean, that's as huge as anything.
Yeah, for sure.
So, random question, but one that is definitely worth weighing in on just because it's such a slick system when it's done right. A guy was asking about how to set up a quick disconnect with his bladder in the Sawyer filter. So I guess, Steve, first, before you get into that, for context, this is something we've addressed in terms of gear that we use, but talk about the setup first in terms of what's the Sawyer filter and a bladder, how they work together, and then talk about the quick disconnect option.
Yeah, we stumbled on the Sawyer filter, gosh, Lenny, four years ago?
Yeah, I think so.
Something like that. It's just an amazing, lightweight, simple-to-use filter. The only con to it is it's called a hollow fiber filter. And if you leave water inside of it and it gets, you know, it's got to get below freezing and really it's got to get well below freezing. The water inside could expand and crack those fibers and you wouldn't necessarily know that. Very, very easy to avoid. All you got to do is shake out the filter at the end of pumping or the end of the day. We just do it every single time because it will hold like a you know, an ounce or two of water inside of it and leak inside your pack if you don't shake it out. So other than that, it's amazing. It's super light. It's like 2 ounces. Very easy system to use. There's, you know, forever everyone's used to the, you know, just sitting there at the creek pumping away, you know, till their arm about falls off. The Sawyer is a squeeze filter, so it's basically a pouch that comes with it that you fill up in the creek. And I think that was one of our hangups when I first saw it, was thinking that was going to be hard to do because it's not, you can't just drop this, you know, the pre-filter in the water and pump from it. You actually need kind of flowing water. Turned out to be the complete opposite because we find way more little like tiny waterfalls and stuff when we're out there than we do standing water. So it's really easy to fill up. Then you basically fill up a pouch, which you call your dirty pouch, screw the filter on, and then from there it has a quick connect. So your bladder goes inside your pack. And this was one of, you know, when we were designing the Exo, it was one of the things that we wanted to make sure we avoided was having a bladder pouch that was completely buried inside the pack. Cause when you have to pump and get access to your bladder, it's kind of a pain in the butt. You had to yard sale all your crap all over the place. just to get it out. So that's why that we put loops inside the side pouches there. Anyways, you basically take your bladder tube and you buy the Sawyer Quick Connect system. Super easy. It's like $8. We sell them on the SNS Archery website. And split your tube in half with a pair of scissors. Put the two male-female parts in there. Connect them together. And then when you go to, you fill up your dirty bag, you screw the filter onto that, and then you just quick connect. You basically take that connection that you on your bladder tube, pull it apart, and then put the male part into the female. So now you're just squeezing right out of the dirty bag through the filter into your bladder. And it's just the simplest, easiest setup. If the flow rate is extremely fast, you know, you can get a full 100-ounce bladder done in a matter of minutes, and then you fill up your dirty bag for later use. You know, all these mule deer hunts we do where water is a precious commodity, you know, we pack around to basically 5 liters of water, 2 bags full at any given time, and it's just an awesome setup.
Yeah, for sure. As you mentioned, the time saved from pumping, the energy saved from pumping, and then that piece you just mentioned there at the end, just to reiterate that, because that's a huge advantage, being able to just carry the dirty water and then filter at any time. So,
yeah,
I mean, if you guys are on a traditional pump system with a single bladder, you're obviously limited to the capacity of that single bladder. So just having a dirty bag and a clean bag alone, like just that factor, man, is so critical.
There's so plenty critical. Of times we've, like, middle of an elk hunt, we come across a water source, and we know the country and know maybe there's not some, once we start climbing, we're not going to get any more water, we'll just fill that dirty bag up real quick and then just throw it in the pack, and then you can mess with filtering it later. It's such a awesome system.
Yeah, for sure. Awesome. Let's see. We had a few other on gear. Oh, okay, so this guy's saying, assuming I have my weapon of choice, pack, boots, and clothing situated, what is the next essential piece of gear I should invest in for a backcountry hunt at higher elevations, like 8,000 feet and above? So he has weapon, pack, boots, and clothing. And I would say those are good priorities, but what would you count as essential or critical after those priorities?
I would definitely say sleeping bag and shelter.
Yeah.
I mean, because that's huge. I mean, for one, you're not going to sleep good, and two, I mean, frankly, it could kill you if you don't have you know what you need there. So, if you're going to spend some money, you know, definitely put it in those two areas, and obviously glass too. I mean, if you start going back to hunting, I mean, good optics are huge. If you're talking about backpacking, I'd definitely say a good tent and a good bag. I mean, because the thing is, if you spend some money on that up front, it just lasts you for so long.
Right.
And it's so worth it.
Yeah, for sure.
So I'd say, don't skimp there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that goes back to obviously the sleeping question, but you start skimping on a pad or a bag and you're freezing or uncomfortable. It's just not worth it for sure.
So, I agree.
Yeah, I think he nailed it on the head there of the first four items. The two that are the most critical, in my opinion, I think Lenny's the same, is your pack and boots. Those are essentially your vehicles of the backcountry. Your boots protect your feet, and your pack is going to carry all your gear and get the meat out of there. You know, you don't want to skimp in those two departments. And from there, weapons, obviously, very, very important. The rest of it, you know, the cool thing about backpacking gear is that it doesn't have to be crazy expensive to get into. The more you spend, in some regards, you're just buying lighter weight, not necessarily higher quality. Like a Big Agnes tent, you know, they've got a super lightweight Flycreek, and then they're, I'm blanking on the other model up from that. What's the
Copper
one
you can?
Copper? No, that's the other lightweight one. One Jason uses.
The Seed House?
Seed House, yeah. You know, it's the exact same tent, just heavier materials. You can buy good Kelty down bags that, you know, like Lenny said, Lenny, you bought that Moonstone bag with 10 years ago, and a high quality bag is going to last you forever. And those are great investments, but you don't necessarily have to. I mean, if you just want to get started, Kelty makes some great bags for, you know, $150 that are, you know, going to be synthetic and heavy, but they're going to suffice. man, I'm trying to think of what else. You know, good stove is worth its weight in gold. We love the jet boils. On a mule deer hunt, optics would probably be the next thing down.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Sure. Trying to think what else. Yeah, clothing's obviously very important. And that's kind of, I mean, those are the major ones for sure.
Yeah.
And I definitely say, you know, I mean, I look back at, you know, when I first got started, like, just expect that you're probably going to upgrade gear and, you know, don't go just because you can't afford the best stuff. I mean, I started off with a big, heavy sleeping bag and a big, heavy tent. And then, you know, just over time, you start figuring out what you want and then, you know, you start piecing it together. So just get what you can and get out there.
Lenny, we're going to have to make the cover photo of this issue or this episode, your photo from back in the day. It's pretty freaking awesome.
I will do that.
Yeah. What's the story on that, Lenny?
Oh, yeah. I was going through some old photos back when I first started, and man, I've got one. It was real early, like external pack. I mean, sleeping bag all the way on the outside. Then I upgraded from that to like a 7,000 cubic inch Eureka. And I still somehow filled the whole thing up. And I think I had my sleeping bag on the outside of that thing. it's funny, in this place where I used to go hunt, and it was like 2,500 feet straight up. And I don't even know how the heck I carried that thing, but yeah, I'll definitely show that off. Cause I mean, the thing is like, you got to go in the backcountry confident with your gear that you have, and you can't be confident being minimalist unless you've done it.
Yeah,
that's and that's a great just point. All there is to it.
Yeah.
And so when you first go out, you're going to take more stuff than what you need, and the only way that you're going to figure out that you don't need it is you're going to get confident that you've been out there and that you don't need it. And so just know you're going to go the first couple times and it's going to be heavy and you'll figure out what you need and what you don't need.
Yeah, for sure.
I just talked to a guy today that is coming out to Wyoming next year for a 7-day backpack hunt. He's wanting to know 3,500 or 5,500 and it's going to be his first trip. And he was really like, well, all the research I'm done, the 3,500, I should be able to make work. And I was like, yeah, you should. But to be honest with you, it's your first backpacking trip. And I don't care who you are, you're just going to pack too much crap because unless you're, you know, a badass willing to, you know, die out there, you're just not going to know what you need until you do it. And you're going to pack a lot of stuff on those first trips. So, you know, better to go with that bigger bag for when you're just first starting out. And then you can always get a smaller bag down the road.
Yeah, yep,
exactly.
Yeah, great points. I mean, I feel like I've said this a bunch on the podcast, but I always played the game of like three strikes and you're out. And so on that whole idea of what do you need, what do you not need, I just want to reiterate to pay attention to what you do take. Have a list, even if you're just starting. And then every time you come back from a trip, go through that list and go, did I use this? Did I not use this? Did I really need this? Did I not need this? And obviously there's some things that you're not going to use, and maybe you won't even use it on like three consecutive trips, but you do need it, you know, first aid, for example. But, you know, there's clearly some things like your second knife or your whatever, you know, that guys have for like this whole reassurance thing that, you know, they could begin to whittle out. And that, you know, I think, you know, the last thing that any of the three of us want to come off as elitist because we try to be more on the minimal or ultralight side. It's not that. It's just a matter of we've, you know, as you said, Lenny, gone through that experience of what are we comfortable taking and what are we comfortable leaving behind. And that's up to the individual. And, you know, as you said, only experience can teach you that lesson.
Yep.
Let's see. Yeah.
Well, one thing that a topic that is a real basic question, and just that same guy reminded me of, I was talking to, is his next question is, what the heck do I do for scent in the backcountry? Real basic question. And he was kind of in shock when I told him nothing.
Yeah. That's the answer.
Because it doesn't matter what you do, or, I mean, you can't pack enough soap and scent bottles to keep yourself scent free back there on a multi-day extended hunt. So, I mean, Lenny and I, we were at home, you wash your clothes and scent free soap. I hang them up to dry. So they're, you know, going into a hunt, they're as clean and scent free as they can be. I think Lenny, sometimes you pack deodorant every once in a while, right? But not always.
Yeah. You know, that's one of those things early on I did, and I probably haven't for 4 years. Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say, I remember in the past getting some from me, but that doesn't, yeah, doesn't seem like it's been a few years.
Ever since he started full body shaving, he left the deodorant at home.
But yeah, we don't do anything. I mean, I do, I basically have two kind of base layers, the First Light Lano and their Chama hoodie. And so I'll, like, maybe on an off day, if I get a chance, I'll wash that Lano in a creek just to kind of get the dirt and muck out of it and let it kind of dry, and I'll wear the Chama for a day. But that's about it. I mean, it just, you know, I've kind of, the more I hunt, the more I'm under the opinion, you know, I mean, a whitetail guy is probably a whole different world, but where we're at, it doesn't matter what you've done. If the wind's blowing the wrong direction, you're screwed. So yeah, you're never going to get away with that. Yeah. So we just, it's frankly a non-issue, and you just do your best to hunt with the wind in your face. And you know, that's sometimes an impossible task. Our elk season was a reflection of that, where the wind was just, you know, we just say it's blowing everywhere because it is. And you know, it makes it impossible to hunt, but that's just part of the game.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like there's nothing you can do, not because it doesn't matter, but because you have zero control. Like, even if you did everything theoretically perfect, you're just not going to beat their nose, you know?
Yeah. Yep.
Yep. Sure. That's a great point. And, you know, just to wrap up on gear, and especially for you guys who are newer, man, there's very few reasons and very few items that you need to buy new. And so I would just, you know, reiterate, as we're talking about gear, you know, we talked about shelter. Buy a freaking used one. Like, figure out what you like, and don't make the investment up front necessarily on all this new gear that, as Lenny mentioned earlier, you're probably going to be upgrading or changing later after you try it. So look used, you know, look at, you know, like REI, they do twice a year the 20% off, which is, you know, can be a good deal on certain things if you are buying new. And, you know, while we mentioned REI, not everything has to be from a hunting company, especially, I mean, you know, even clothing. There's certainly advantages to, like, First Light Merino wool. There can be advantages to camouflage. But if you're on a budget, I mean, don't feel like you have to be decked out in the latest and greatest hunting everything when there's great mountaineering or general outdoor gear that, you know, can suffice. And a lot of times you can find a better deal on. So just want to throw that out there, for you guys as you're gearing up for future hunts as well.
I agree.
Let's see. A guy asked a question about rifle caliber differences. What's good caliber for certain animals and what's overkill? What we're not going to do is answer that question and tell you to come back in a few more episodes, because we discussed that for about an hour. if you guys haven't caught, you know, we've kind of been hinting at a rifle series that we have upcoming, and seriously, that's one of the episodes that we dove into for about an hour with an expert, and we're certainly not those experts, but had an awesome discussion about that exact question, like what's good for what animals, what is quote-unquote enough, what is, you know, enough but probably more than you need, all those topics we dive into. So definitely stay tuned to the podcast for that. Moving down the line, actually, just on the scent control, we had a guy asking about stalking tips and scent control, which we clearly addressed. But the other aspect of stalking that he was talking about and wanted to know more information about was on being quiet. So general advice there on being quiet. I mean, a lot of things come into play. Again, even differences on the species that you're hunting. I mean, the more time I spend around elk, the less I'm concerned about noise. I mean, just it's like so low on my radar, in terms of there's so many more important things, like movement and clearly wind being the priority, that I'm not afraid to make noise. And sometimes I'm intentionally making noise. But, you know, let me talk a bit about mule deer, for example, and what are you doing when it comes time to close the distance, and particular steps that you take to be quiet?
Yeah, I definitely agree with you on the elk. I think it's kind of a non-issue from mule deer. It's everything. And so, you know, historically, I carry an extra pair of socks, you know, in my pack. Frankly, it's my stocking socks. And so, you know, once I get to that 100, 150 yards, kind of depending, you know, what the terrain is, how much the wind's blowing. I mean, because the wind has a lot to do with it, because the wind's blowing hard. You don't even need to take your boots off because they can't hear anything. But if it's not blowing, you know, definitely get down to the socks. Or I don't know if you guys have seen Travis Nowotny. He has a stalker boot, actually, that he's come out with that actually goes right over the top of your socks. And then, you know, to me, it's huge. It's key for mule deer. I don't think you can cover that last, you know, 100 yards without it, to be honest with you.
Yeah. How about for you, Steve?
Yeah, same thing. Elk, I vary my tactics a little bit. Lenny drives me nuts sometimes when he's just running around breaking branches. but yeah, I mean, for elk, they are definitely a noisy creature, and you can get away with stuff. If you're actually trying to stalk one, I wouldn't think you'd want to make a sound, right? You know, if you're going in there calling and kind of being a part of the herd, that's a different situation. But if you got a bedded bull, you probably need to be at least somewhat quiet. I take off my shoes a lot when I'm hunting, you know, and just get into my socks. It's such a, you know, when you just go, cause in your socks, I mean, it hurts on your feet, but you can just be extremely stealthy. One tip is I'll tuck my pant legs into my socks. And that kind of helps your pant leg from brushing on something. And, yeah, for mule deer, Lenny hit it on the nail on the head. It's just, you know, we get above a buck once he's bedded. Wait for the late thermals. Hopefully the wind is picked up, and that makes your job and life a lot easier. Plenty of stalks we've done where, you know, those afternoon thermals kick up for like just 30 seconds, and it kind of blows real hard. And then, you know, you just move like 10 feet really quick as fast as you can. You're just trying to cut that distance. And then you sit there for 30 minutes and wait for the next gust. So sometimes, you know, there's not much you can do. But just get in your socks. Yeah, Travis's stalking shoes, I used a pair of those a couple times this year. They're awesome. You know, definitely saves your feet in that comfort department. You can be on your, you know, when you're in your socks for more than like an hour or two, you really appreciate what the boots do for you, and you look forward to getting to them. What was that? That was 3 years ago, Lenny, when we were stalking that buck, and we ended up in our socks, and I was filming, and Lenny was shooter, and we had a buck like 100 yards below us, and it was getting late, and we're just like, all right, let's pull up our shoes, and you're just going to go down there and shoot them real quick. And then we get down there, that buck jumped, and then we see another buck down the hill, like 500 yards, just like rock, cliff, just nasty freaking stuff. And I somehow we ended up all the way in the bottom of this thing chasing that buck with like 1,500 feet to climb back up of just like, I mean, just sharp freaking rock. And I never appreciated my boots so much once we got up to them. But anyways, yeah, it's, you know, just get your socks, don't be afraid to take your boots off. You know, tough it out. It's not going to be comfortable, but it's going to really increase your chances on a mule deer. And that's all early season. Obviously, if it's late in the snow, you're not going to be taking your boots off. But yeah.
And the other thing I'd say there is I'll pretty much always drop my pack at that same point in time.
Yeah.
And then we have our Slurpee Stalker, which, you know, allows you to throw that in your back and move and keep you some water. Cause I mean, that's everything. I mean, cause like Steve said, I mean, we've been out there, you know, 3 hours waiting for a buck to stand up. And if you don't have a little bit of water with you standing there in your socks, you're going to do something stupid and push it and screw it up. So that's huge.
Yeah. Good point. Awesome. Well, we're coming up on time, so let's wrap there. But we have some other great questions from you guys that you've already sent in about resources on how to, you know, maintain, repair, tune your bow, tools needed for that, questions about packing out game, questions about hunting solo. So we will certainly do this again for you guys. But if there's a question we didn't answer in this episode or didn't just mention, we would certainly love to hear any others that you guys want to hear about. So again, there's no stupid questions. Just shoot us an email to podcast@exomountaingear.com, and we'll do our best to cover it in what will become part two of this little mini series that we're doing. So Steve, Lenny, thanks for joining us. Well, thank you so much for listening, guys. Don't forget part two coming next week in the series. If you have any other questions that you want to see answered, big or small, from beginner or experienced, we would love to tackle that. Go ahead and email us to podcast@exomountaingear.com. Thank you. If you have left a review on iTunes, we sincerely appreciate that. If you haven't, we would love to see your review on iTunes. or any other feedback, just straight to us, to podcast@exomountaingear.com. Hope you've enjoyed this one. The next one is going to be even better.